White Women, Miss Anne, and the Harlem Renaissance.
This was some of the history behind the term, and it was the long history against which the women I write about had to set themselves. The women I write about did not want to be dismissed as Miss Anne. They wanted to be part of the Black Harlem Renaissance. They wanted to contribute meaningfully to the Harlem Renaissance, and part of what they were up against was a white racist society that said, you may not go there, and if you go there, you can't come home. But they were also up against the Miss Anne image, the Miss Anne idea, and Miss Anne was who they did not want to be.
That's Carla Kaplan. We talk with her about her acclaimed new book, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And later, we re-air a clip from our interview with Rilla Askew about the impact of anti-immigration laws. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Briannan. When my guest Carla Kaplan was researching her book about the great Black novelist Zora Neale Hurston, she became interested in the white women who played a part in the artistic and intellectual phenomenon of the 1920s known as the Harlem Renaissance. Now Kaplan has come out with a cultural history of those women called Miss Anne in Harlem. The book's cover photo shows a crowd of Black couples dancing at a party, with one lone white woman standing pensively among them. She's there, but seemingly unnoticed by the others, which is very much how history has treated the white women who crossed the rigid barriers of race to become part of what was called the New Negro Movement. Some as writers on racial themes, some as philanthropists, some as thrill seekers. Their motivations were complicated, as were their attitudes towards race. One reviewer wrote, in this remarkable work of historical recovery, Carla Kaplan resurrects Miss Anne as a cultural figure and explores the messy contradictions of her life, moving her from the periphery of a story about white patronage and boundary-testing interracial liaisons to the center. Carla Kaplan is an acclaimed cultural scholar who currently teaches at Northeastern University. In addition to Miss Anne in Harlem, she's the author of The Erotics of Talk and Zora Neale Hurston, A Life in Letters. For listeners in Western Massachusetts, Carla Kaplan will be speaking at the Odyssey Bookshop in South Hadley on Wednesday, October 16th at 7 p.m. So, Carla Kaplan, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thank you so much for having me.
This is just one of the most terrific books I've read. It is such a rich history and so thought-provoking. Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Renaissance, and nobody else has written about this, which is so astonishing. Tell us first, who is Miss Anne, and how did she get that name?
It's a good place to start, because it was a difficult choice in some ways to use that in the title. Miss Anne is a term used in the Black community. It has a long history as a derisive, dismissive, insulting term for white women. Mildly insulting. There are harsher things to say. Miss Anne was a term that would be used in a context such as, oh, don't listen for her, she works for Miss Anne. And it was a nifty way for the Black community to turn the tables on the white community by creating a category for all white women and putting them into it and setting them aside. And that kind of categorical treatment was, of course, you know, one of the things that had happened to Black people for centuries. So it was a little bit of a turning of the tables, a little bit of comeuppance. It was specifically used, it was most frequently used to reference white women employers. And it was a reflection of the Black community's resentment that white women had gone along for so long with, particularly in the South, with a racist culture that said Black men were dangerous, that white women had not, in a really aggressive way, in the post-slavery years and in the 1920s, come out against the practice of lynching and their own sort of role in that, because so much of the lynching of black men was a consequence of the myth that black men were a danger to white women. And the black community looked for so long to white women to say this is nonsense and felt that had not happened. And so there was a long and rightful history of skepticism at best and fear often of white women's potential for damage and danger to the black community. And all of that, in a sense, is encapsulated in the phrase Miss Anne. Miss Anne is a phrase with instant recognition in the black community. If you drop the phrase Miss Anne into any room of black people, everybody sort of snickers and laughs. Until very recently, I think Miss Anne was a phrase with almost no recognition at all amongst whites. And for me, that speaks to the fact that even today, when we pride ourselves on how far we've come, we really often live in completely separate worlds, where something can have great meaning to one group and no meaning to another. So this was some of the history behind the term, and it was the long history against which the women I write about had to set themselves. The women I write about did not want to be dismissed as Miss Anne. They wanted to be part of the Black Harlem Renaissance. They wanted to contribute meaningfully to the Harlem Renaissance, and part of what they were up against was a white racist society that said, you may not go there, and if you go there, you can't come home. But they were also up against the Miss Anne image, the Miss Anne idea, and Miss Anne was who they did not want to be.
Yeah, in fact, you say she was often dismissed as a sexual adventurer or a lunatic. I mean, that's a pretty extreme.
Yes. The white press in particular looked at any white woman who took anything other than the most passing interest in black culture and either insisted that it was all sexual or that she was crazy, and sometimes both. So one of the white women who was held up for years in the white press as a cautionary tale, as a warning to other white women, do not do this, was Etta Duryea, the white wife of black boxer Jack Johnson. Johnson, in his day, was almost as famous for taking white wives as he was for his athletic prowess, for which he was renowned. And Etta Duryea, one of his white wives, killed herself. And the white press, whenever it would catch wind of white women have a very serious interest in black culture, black people of any kind, political, cultural, social, of any sort, would sort of trump out, would bring out Etta Duryea as a kind of a warning. Many of the women I write about, again, who were very serious about their commitment to black culture and politics, they put Black Harlem at the center of their lives, found that everything they did was sexualized by the white press. Can I give you an example?
Oh, yeah.
So Mary White Ovington, white founder of the NAACP, a factoid not everybody knows, was doing her work in the 1920s. At that point, she was, I believe, well into her 70s. She was, by design, a very matronly woman. She cultivated a kind of matronly image. And she had lived all her life as very much a single woman. She believed deeply that for her to be effective in a black community, because of the complicated history of white women in black culture, she had to avoid any undue attention. And she strove very, very mightily not to draw any attention to herself. So she was not someone who cultivated press attention. But the press sort of became fascinated by her interracial, social, political, cultural gatherings in the 1920s. She ran some of the most important, well, today we would call them literary salons, interracial literary salons. And the white press, so here is this woman with, you know, decades of amazing political credentials, very matronly, in her 70s, long political record behind her. And the white press ran stories about Mary White Ovington, insisting that she had these salons to procure black male lovers for young white women. They just, that was the extent to which the press insisted on sexualizing the interest that white women had in black culture. When that interest was avowedly sexual, as it was in the case of two of the women I write about, Josephine Cogdell Schuyler and Nancy Cunard, the press went mad. When the press caught wind of Nancy Cunard's relationship with black jazz musician Henry Crowder, Nancy Cunard received literally mountains of hate mail.
Mm-hmm. You write about identity politics within a racial context, but, you know, there's also gender identity politics that's all mixed up in here. What is your thoughts on why sex becomes such a potent element in the racist construction of whites about white women and blacks?
It's a very complicated question, not just at this historical moment in the 1920s and 30s, but it really remains one at ours. And it's a really important question because it goes to the heart of the complicated and the layered ways in which we construct identity and the way in which we think about, understand identity, and particularly the identities we tell one another we can and can't inhabit. So part of what's going on at this historical moment in the 1920s is that blackness is being constructed in mainstream American culture, and of course the Harlem Renaissance is pushing back against this, but blackness is being constructed in mainstream American culture not just as a negative, not just as an inferior, and people need to remember that the 1920s is a period of some of the most virulent and violent racism in American history. This is not a period in which race taboos are falling by the wayside, quite the contrary. And blackness is being constructed in part as a contagion, as a pollutant. And there is an idea that it works almost like a virus would work. And there is a very different notion in mainstream culture about how the contagion of blackness affects white men and white women. White men were actually encouraged to expose themselves to blackness almost medicinally. It was understood to be good for white men in small doses and even a kind of a health tonic for them. For white women, on the other hand, it was understood entirely differently. It was understood that if white women overexposed themselves to blackness, and this was the phrase that was used constantly in the press, overexposure, that if white women overexposed themselves to blackness, they would darken. They would lose their whiteness. They would become black. So this is connected both to the one-drop rule of race, the idea that one drop of black blood made you black, but from the notion of the one-drop rule becomes very quickly a sexual notion, right? That blackness can somehow be transmitted by social or sexual exposure. You can't have this idea that white women can darken themselves through social or sexual intercourse with blacks without the one-drop rule. The one-drop rule becomes a kind of a metaphor for the exchange of racial bodily fluids, if you will. It's a sort of crazy notion, but it's important for people to understand it is completely prevalent at the time. It's taken for granted in the culture.
You're listening to Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Carla Kaplan about her terrific study of the white women of the Black Renaissance. It's called Miss Anne in Harlem. So you're talking about context now, and you've just mentioned this was one of the most racist periods. I mean, this was a time when people were selling postcards about lynchings, and they were very popular. But the other context, I mean, that's the larger racist context, but the context, also the smaller one, but no less important, is that of the Harlem Renaissance. Tell us about the Harlem Renaissance. How did it arise, and when was it? When did it flourish?
The Harlem Renaissance, most historians date as coming about right after and partly as a consequence of the end of World War One. When you have highly decorated black soldiers returning, particularly from France, where they've been treated with extraordinary regard and respect, to an American culture in which there is either active Jim Crow throughout the South or a kind of Jim Crow mentality. And they come back from the war saying, we are not going to tolerate this anymore. We are not going to take second-class citizenship. At the same time, you have, as part of the confluence of forces that come together, you have the Great Migration of blacks escaping both Jim Crow in the South, but also the agricultural crisis that is hitting at right this point and pouring in to, you know, what we know to have been the sort of great northern centers like Detroit, Chicago, and specifically New York. And Harlem is a neighborhood in which blacks are able to make a real estate incursion, and in the way of such things, it spirals and it becomes the national, indeed the international mecca for African Americans. And it becomes a symbol, because what happens early on in the 1920s, partly as a result of economic opportunity and partly as a result of historical timing but also geographic concentration, is an extraordinary flowering, even you could say an explosion, of black cultural and political activity and expression. So within just a few years in the 1920s, hundreds of black newspapers and journals were started, almost all of them with national subscription. This is the period in which you have the small literary magazines. You have small theaters cropping up on almost every corner. Along with a church on every corner, you have an experimental theater. You have political organizations like the Urban League and the NAACP. You have a range of literary societies, from those that are in official institutions like the New York Public Library, which is famous for its Harlem branch, to unofficial salons throughout the culture. And then, of course, you have the famous nightclubs with the incredible jazz bands all over Harlem. You have the ones that have become most famous, like the Cotton Club. It's ironic the Cotton Club is most famous because it had a whites-only patron policy. But you have also the lesser-known clubs where blacks and whites could mingle. And one of the ironies of this period, this is a moment in American history, like ours, which is filled with really extraordinary contradictions. Because you have one of the most violently, virulently racist moments in American cultural history, and you have what Langston Hughes always called the vogue for blackness. Harlem is so popular as a white tourist destination in the 1920s that there was a small industry of tourist books written specifically for white slummers, telling them which nightclubs to go to in Harlem and where to go. There was a great tradition of whites going up into Harlem to go to the Harlem nightclubs to watch black people, and then, of course, you know, after a couple of hours, scurrying into taxi cabs and hightailing it right back downtown. And one of the things that Miss Anne was also up against, if she, or that the white women of Harlem were also up against, if they chose to go deeper than that, if they wanted to make a serious contribution to African American culture, was they needed to differentiate themselves from these tourists, from these slummers who came up from downtown or from Kansas City to go to the nightclubs for 2 hours.
In fact, you have, I'd like to get back to that last point, but you have an incredible illustration among many in this book of a tourist map that, you know, has, it's just so racist in the stereotypes. You know, it's got a black woman who is wearing a jungle tutu dancing with, a thick lip banjo strummer. Comment on that, and there's also a New Yorker cover that's similar to that.
Life magazine cover.
Oh, Life magazine, okay.
It's Life magazine, so it's even worse, right, because it's really national, with a dancing flapper, and she is a classic, iconic flapper. And behind her, almost as wallpaper, you actually have to look twice. is this constantly repeated, much, much smaller than her, image that is supposed to be a male dancing African savage. And these illustrations speak to this very layered set of complicated and conflicting racial ideas at the time. One of the things that was fueling the vogue for Harlem, the vogue for black culture at this moment in American culture, was the prevalence of what we now call primitivism. And primitivism was an ideology which held that it was connected to the modernists in some ways, and primitivism held that modern white civilization was washed out, was arid, was lacking, was somehow, you know, just was not vital any longer. And I think one of the ways in which everybody has seen that idea is in Fitzgerald's The Wasteland. Of course, everybody knows The Great Gatsby. And The Wasteland was a reference in some ways to this primitivist idea that modern white urban civilized American culture was a kind of a spiritual and an emotional, even a sexual wasteland. And the idea, very prevalent at the time throughout mainstream culture, was that the way to revitalize a arid white culture was to infuse it with the energies of so-called primitive peoples. So some looked to Tahiti, and I think a lot of people know that art. Some looked to the American Southwest and to Native American cultures. Most looked to Africa. And that's why you see that life cover with the flapper and the dancing African behind her, with this notion that the energies of so-called primitive African cultural peoples could revitalize whites. But again, to go back to what you and I were talking about earlier, there was this idea that that worked medicinally for white men, and it worked medicinally for white women only if they exposed themselves in very controlled ways. Right? If they didn't, again, the word was overexpose themselves. So one of the ironies of this moment is that you have a racist culture but a great love of blackness. For blacks, you have the problem of a lot of interest in the culture and a lot of love on the part of white people, but it's a love that is very circumscribed by an ideology which is certainly insulting, which is certainly demeaning, which is to say, most of white culture fell in love with black culture for its own reasons, for its own purposes. And so Harlem has to decide, well, we're getting a lot of attention. It's not really the attention we want, but it is attention. Do we refuse it, or do we try to move it in a slightly better direction? And as anyone can imagine, this was a source of pretty much constant debate throughout the Harlem Renaissance.
Hmm. We're speaking with Carla Kaplan about her terrific book, A Study of the White Women of the Black Renaissance. It's called Miss Anne in Harlem. And so what were the differing sides? How did they shape up?
Well, one of the things that I found so fascinating and that makes the story of the white women who truly tried to make a place for themselves in Black Harlem such an interesting story is that what you see is not just, as you say, the taking of sides, because you certainly see throughout the Harlem Renaissance the taking of sides, and you even see a kind of resentment about that. You know, here we are with our own, you know, Renaissance, with our own cultural flowering, and we have to devote so much attention to talking about white people. You know, here we are having our Renaissance, and we're stuck all the time debating about what to do with the white fascination people have for us. So there was a certain resentment for that. But you also see that the taking of sides is highly fluid. And what I mean by that is that the very people who say at one moment, let's try to exclude whites from this so that we really can focus on self-determination and self-definition, will turn around at another moment and say, no, let's welcome this white interest. So if I could give you an example of this, one of the two most important publications in Black America at this time is The Crisis Magazine. This is the official publication of the NAACP, which is one of the organizations which is working hardest to try to navigate between these rocks and these hard places, working hardest to try to turn white fascination in a positive direction. And one of the things that the crisis does, it's really a fascinating but a kind of a risky maneuver, is it takes a part of the magazine that had long been called the Poets Page, which was just, you know, its literary page devoted to poets. A lot of people are writing poetry at this time, many more than are writing poetry now. And it starts turning the Poets Page over to white poets and turning the Poets Page into a dedicated forum for white views about race. And one of the things you see if you start looking at the weekly Poets Page from this period is when it starts turning over to white poets is the craziest mix of writings. So on one page alone, you have something I put as the frontispiece of my book, which is a poem called A White Girl's Prayer, in which a young white woman longs to be bronze, yellow, or black, and she expresses her desperation to become black and to get away from whiteness. There's also a poem from Nancy Cunard written in the voice of an angry black man threatening to kill the white crackers, a very insulting term for white people of the South. So here's Nancy speaking, white Nancy speaking as a black man killing white people. But on the very same page, there is a classic racist poem that could have been written 100 years prior by a white woman celebrating the charm of little black pickaninnies. And all of this appears on the same page. This is reflective of what happens in Harlem. It's a long answer to your question, but the taking of sides often becomes, it's too hard to take sides, we're just going to allow everything. This is so complicated that what we're going to promote is getting everything on the table, good, bad, indifferent, and everything in between, as a way of letting all of our readers or all of our audience or all of our people explore the full range of possibilities. And faced with this dilemma, this crisis of how do we do this, how do we choose sides, what do we promote, what many of the black Harlem intellectuals came to decide was let's just go for all of it and see if that pushes the envelope. It was a very interesting strategic choice, the opposite of what we would today call political correctness. Mm-hmm. And it fascinated me because it was something that really opened a kind of an avenue for the white women I write about. These were women who came with serious commitments to trying to contribute to black advancement. But these were women who also came with their own baggage. None of them were able to escape their backgrounds, and they were not able to set aside their own racial ideologies, many of which were, by our standards, entirely cringeworthy. Mm. And because there was such a sense of, let's just put it all out there, let's welcome it all, they were able to become participants at this moment. And I think that the openness to a range of attitudes was part of what allowed the white women I write about in this book to become part of the movement.
Carla Kaplan talking about her book, Miss Anne in Harlem. We'll talk more after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking with acclaimed cultural scholar Carla Kaplan about her fascinating study of the white women of the Black Renaissance of the 1920s. It's called Miss Anne in Harlem. Well, what you're talking about really does get to the heart of the sheer complicatedness, the complicated ball of wax that is race in America. And you write about six women. I mean, you feature six, starting with Lillian Wood, who I found that was a very fascinating section of the book. And they're almost mini biographies who express all these different kinds of contradictions. Could we start with Lillian Wood? Even just briefly, you say in your chapter of her, about her, is Lillian Wood passes for Black. I don't think that's something she herself chose to do. But so how did it come about that the world thought that she was Black, and who was she and what did she do?
I start the book with Lillian Wood because when the white women I write about decided to put Harlem at the heart of their lives and to make lives for themselves as participants and activists in Black Harlem, one of the things they faced was an absence of role models. They did not have very many white women to look towards who had done what they were trying to do, because people have to remember, really, they were crossing an unthinkable line at the time. This was something that was not just a taboo, but was considered a sort of unthinkable choice. One of the only models they could look back to were what we often call the Yankee school marms, the white women who had gone south to teach in the newly formed Black schools in the wake of emancipation and after the Freedmen's Bureau schools. And there were waves of mostly young, mostly New England white women who went south to do this kind of social service work. And they were often seen as very, very positive, important, even heroic figures in the Black community because they had done this at some sacrifice. Now, most of them went south, did this work almost as missionaries, and then returned home. So that was very much the common pattern. Lillian Wood was a woman in that pattern originally who never went back home again, and who really became part of, in every sense, a small Black college in Tennessee, and wrote a novel in the 1920s that was one of the very important in the time indictments of lynching. And one of the things that was interesting about her novel, Let My People Go, is that as part of her indictment of lynching, which African Americans were desperately trying to get federal legislation against, to no avail, throughout the 1920s. So she's very aware of what was happening in D.C. and in Harlem politically. As part of her indictment of lynching, Lillian Wood, teaching in Tennessee, in Appalachian Tennessee, in an all-Black college, her indictment includes one of the most chilling portrayals of white women you could possibly imagine. She portrays white women as monstrous. And because of this, ever since that book appeared, bibliographers have simply assumed she must be a Black writer, because it was taken for granted that no white writer would depict white women in this way. The very same thing in some ways happened to Annie Nathan Meyer, who wrote another chilling indictment of lynching called Black Souls. And she is a case of what I call passive passing. She was assumed, Lillian Wood, to be a Black person, and she never corrected that. I think for her, there may have been a sort of a secret and a small pleasure in having done a job of writing that was so effective that people just, you know, took for granted, well, she must be a Black writer, because she must have been aware that she was listed in all the anthologies as African American, and she never sent in a correction. She was a librarian, so I do think it's quite unlikely that she didn't know. And she didn't make any effort to correct that. When she first went to teach in the college, many of the faculty of these Black schools was white, and when you look at the early photographs of her, she doesn't particularly stand out. But she stays there for decades. And by the end of her time in Knoxville College, she is the only white faculty member still standing in the annual faculty photo. And it was part of her commitment, but it was also part of her new life. She had really left behind a white world and moved into a black world, and that's where she saw herself.
Mm. So you mentioned Annie Nathan Meyer. That was also a very compelling story of her play, Black Souls. Tell us who she was, and then tell us about the play.
Annie Nathan Meyer, if she is known as at all today, is known as the founder of Barnard. And she was a young woman who was born into a family that was almost at the time considered sort of the royalty of American Jewry. And the Nathans were a family, they were related on one side to Emma Lazarus, to Supreme Court justices. And part of what she did with that sense of coming from a notable family was insisting on education for women. And like a number of other white women I write about, in the 20s, she became fascinated with Black Harlem. Part of the story of Annie Nathan Meyer in Black Harlem is the story of Black and Jewish relations. And a number of the whites, male and female, who became involved in Black Harlem were Jews. And there's an interesting side story to that, because, of course, Jews at this time in American culture are not white people. They are not considered white. But when they become involved in Black culture and in Black Harlem, they stand out as white people. And that's a kind of an interesting side story, the way in which for American Jews being inside of Black culture makes them white in a way they would never have been white anywhere else. But Annie Nathan Meyer does become active in the Harlem Renaissance. She is a dear friend of Zora Neale Hurston, amongst others. She writes a play called Black Souls, which is so controversial that she is unable to see it staged for 8 years. It is not staged until the early 1930s, when the very experimental and radical Provincetown Playhouse mounts a production of it. And even then, it is so controversial, the play has to close after 10 performances. Because at the heart of her play, one of the things Annie Nathan Meyer insists on doing is depicting a young white woman deeply in love with and passionately sexually attracted to a black man. And in her play, the young woman throws herself into the arms of the black man. This was unthinkable. This was not something that had been done or even people thought could be done on the American stage. And as I say, it took 8 years, and then there were only 10 performances, because that insistence that white women were indeed, you know, passionately attracted to black men, in spite of all of the social evidence of the various intermarriages and relationships of blacks and whites, the culture still treated as impossible.
And this was an educated black man.
Yes, this was a very much an educated black man. In fact, in the play, he is one of the returning soldiers who has been highly decorated in the war, and the play drops in. It's just barely there, but it drops in that they had met in Paris, which was often looked to at the time as a much more racially friendly, a much more interracial society than American culture. So it's important that the two had met in Paris, and then they re-meet in the American South at a black college, very much like and modeled on the kind of school Lillian Wood lived her life in. These were schools that often looked to whites for money and for funding. Lillian Wood's college did originally and then later stopped that practice. But in Annie Nathan Meyer's play, the black college is beholden to white money, indeed to a senator who we find out at the end of the play is guilty of raping a black woman. So this is the play embeds the whole complicated history of race relations, North and South, international and American, and then insists that American culture is lying about race. And that insistence was enormously controversial in her day, and the play was not a critical success, and the play was not a commercial success. it was very much a critical success in the black community, and that mattered so much to Annie Nathan Meyer that she held on to the letters that praised the play and to the notes she had received from her black friends until her death. And she constantly looked back to them, and she referred to the approval her play had met with from black people as one of the high points of her entire life, and she referred to it that way until the day she died.
Mm. I know you have to go in 5 minutes, so I want to ask you about one other Miss Anne, who plays a very different role, also Jewish, also a writer. That's Lillian Hurst. Imitation of Life. You write about Lillian Hurst that her vision of black life is at least as pernicious as it was salutary. Why do you say that?
So Fanny Hurst is the one person, is the woman in this book I found myself least able to sympathize with. And I want to say that I made as much of an effort as I could when I worked on each of the women in this book to come to them without prejudgment. Part of my goal, and I'm so glad you said that these worked for you as mini-biographies, because part of my goal was to write a set of mini-biographies in which, as much as I possibly could, I would let each of these women, in their own voice, explain what it was they thought they were doing, how it worked out for them, why they did it, and what the experience was like. And I didn't want to come to it with so much judgment that I couldn't let them speak for themselves. Fanny Hurst was, for me, the hardest writer not to judge. And that was because Fanny Hurst always took from the black community at almost no cost, with almost no consequences, and gave back, in my mind, very little. And I started differentiating between the white women who paid a cost for their experiment of race crossing and who contributed, however complicatedly, however it was mixed, but who really did contribute meaningfully to black culture, and those who I felt simply took from black culture to enhance their own lives and their reputations. And Fanny Hurst's Imitation of Life, the book for which she's best known now, was considered a sensation in Harlem, and it was a runaway bestseller. She wrote it at a time when she didn't feel the critics were taking her seriously enough. She wanted better critical attention, so she wrote her one black novel to get the critics to pay more attention to her. And what she picked up in that story as a sort of subplot was the passing story, the story of a black person passing for white. The interesting thing is how wrong she got it. Black people had been using the passing story for decades, and they used it very specifically. Again and again and again, when there's a story of a black person passing for or pretending to be white, in a black novel, that person goes into white culture and finds they just can't stand it. They want to go back to black culture. Black culture is better. And it was another way for black culture to turn the tables on white racism. Fanny Hurst does the opposite. She has her young black woman pass into white culture and never regret it, never seek to go home again. White critics and readers never noticed the difference. The black community, as you can imagine, felt completely betrayed because she had taken this passing story, not given it the crucial twist at the end of having the passer return to blackness, and then, on the basis of this black novel, she was given a decades-long platform as one of America's most important civil rights speakers. And she loved that platform, and she went around the country talking about civil rights, something she really didn't know very much about. And so it was harder for me to withhold my judgment of her than anyone else in the book.
You write also, you're writing this book not just as a history, but also for its relevance for us today. I mean, we live in a very different time where we are becoming a majority, quote, minority country. More children of mixed race are, you know, being born than our children of one race. The next mayor of New York is most likely to be one of the father of one of those biracial children. He's in a biracial marriage, and it probably is what got him into the position that he's in, because he had such a terrific ad with his son. So talk about what the relevance is for us now. And I haven't mentioned, of course, that Barack Obama is our first black president.
Yes. I mean, we live in such a complex moment where if you look at those sorts of things, at the political figures who advance, at the reason, you know, the candidate for mayor in New York advanced was because of having a biracial family, in part, that gave him a positive edge. We do have a black president. On the other hand, one of the things that struck me about the women I write about in this book is the extent to which the questions they're wrestling with really do remain questions that are unanswered for us. We do not yet know what we think identity is. Can we alter it? Is there an ethics to it? Are we somehow obliged to the people with whom, you know, with the group to which we were born? Do we consider freedom to be escaping the identities that we were born into? Or do we consider freedom the right to inhabit those identities with respect and dignity and recognition from others? We remain, I think, to this day, all over the map in our answer to those questions, even as we've made certain advancements. As these women went into Black Harlem, they were living within a culture, within a larger racist culture. They were living in a culture that was interracial, that was integrated, where it seemed that there were all kinds of possibilities moving forward for interracial work and interracial collaboration, but in which those deep questions about identity were roiling all the debates and were completely unanswered. And at least I see many parallels between that moment and our own.
Hmm. Well, this is just an amazing book. It's a fascinating read, Miss Anne in Harlem, The White Women of the Black Renaissance. And this has been a great interview. Carla Kaplan, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for having me.
Carla Kaplan. You can read an excerpt from Miss Anne in Harlem by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, anti-immigrant laws and the terror they sow. Stay tuned. Over the last several days, supporters of immigrant rights have been rallying all over the country. We thought it would be a good time to hearken back to my interview with Rilla Askew back in January about her novel, Kind of Kin. It takes place after Oklahoma passes one of the earliest and toughest anti-immigration laws in the nation. Like all such laws, it's tearing families apart and terrorizing whole communities, not to speak of riding roughshod over basic human rights. Rilla Askew's own family has felt the impact of those laws, as you'll hear her tell us in this clip from our January interview. This book, Kind of Kin, it's the first novel I've seen that really sets its sights square on the issue of the impact of the immigration laws that have been sweeping the U.S., particularly in the South. This takes place in Oklahoma. There have been others in Arizona and in Alabama. Now, I did not know that Oklahoma was, in fact, the first place to pass an immigration law of this kind. Tell us about this House Bill 1804.
It was passed in 2007, which is the centennial year of Oklahoma. Oklahoma is a very young state, just became a state in 1907. So in that centennial year, in the spring, the Oklahoma State Legislature passed House Bill 1804, and if not the first of its kind, one of the very first of its kind, it may have been the very first, and it was certainly a great surprise to many of us in Oklahoma, not only when it passed, but when it went into effect in November of that year. And just in the months surrounding the time that it went into effect, there were many, many, primarily Hispanic people in Oklahoma who were stopped for driving violations or other sorts of violations and infractions, and, you know, sent to immigration detention centers and eventually deported.
Well, I found this book, I mean, not only is it a terrific novel, but it really made me understand on a gut level just how terrifying these laws are. In the novel, the bill has been passed, and as Kind of Kin opens up, we are with a 10-year-old Dustin who is staying with his aunt Sweet and her husband and his cousin, who's a little bit older. Why is he there?
He's there because his grandfather, with whom he lives, his grandfather has been arrested under the provisions of the fictional state bill. The boy's grandfather, Bob Brown, has been arrested for harboring illegal aliens in his barn in a little rural town in southeastern Oklahoma called Cedar. So when the grandfather is arrested, there's no one to take care of Dustin, and so he has to go stay with his aunt.
There's a very telling scene in your book, Rilla Askew, in Kind of Kin, which takes place in the home of another grandchild. She is older, and she's married to a Mexican who has come here, who is undocumented. Could you describe a little bit about that scene? It felt to me like one that really puts into stark relief what you've just been talking about.
Are you thinking of the scene where...
At the picnic.
Well, isn't that America? There's an Anglo family intermarried with a Mexican family. And so there's a birthday party for the child of Misty Dawn, the granddaughter that you're speaking of, and her husband, Juanito. And at this party, the Mexican family and the Anglo family are all in the yard celebrating at a big barbecue. But there's a language barrier whereby the Mexicans do not go to the side where the Anglos are, and the Anglos don't go to the Mexican side, not out of animosity, but out of not really being able to communicate. And yet, they're all unified by this marriage. So there's tension, there's suspicion on the part of some of the characters, and then there's the young woman, Misty Dawn, who wants to bring her two families together.
You've described this as a novel about people who want to do right but still do wrong, and others who do right in spite of themselves. Could you give us an example of that in the story?
One of the main characters is Aunt Sweet. Well, actually, as we say in Oklahoma, Aunt Sweet, who's Destin's aunt and Misty Dawn's aunt, and she's the one who tries her best to hold her family together. Bob Brown, the grandfather, is her father. He's in jail. She's charged with taking care of this little boy, with trying to arrange things for Misty Dawn, and who's left in dire straits because her husband has been deported. So Sweet tries the best she can to hold her family together, and she keeps making mistakes, not out of ill will, simply because she doesn't really know how to deal with all the pressures that have come to bear on her family because of this law. And because of her father's action in the face of this law. So she's the one who wants to do right and still does wrong. There are other characters, and I would say probably Bob Brown is one of them, who does right in spite of himself. Because the consequences of him taking this action, his family suffers. And yet the awakening in the community and people outside of his family to the consequences of the laws have a really good, strong effect.
How much of this book is actually based on reality? I mean, I understand that you have a situation in your own family which comes close to one of the situations in this book. Is that right?
Mm-hmm. Yes. I have a niece who was married to an undocumented worker, and as a result of that law, her husband was deported. So, you know, we had a family situation where we, you know, came to experience the results of that law, and also the complications of the broken immigration system. One of the things I wanted to do in the book is not write a polemic or not write a position that's only one way of looking at the circumstance. And yes, there has been, over the course of many years, an increasing population of people who don't have legal status and yet live here and, you know, marry here and have children here and work here. And it's grown over the course of decades, so that many, many families are affected. And the families that are affected are not necessarily all Hispanic families. And, of course, immigration issues apply to all immigrant populations. And so the question is very, very large. But in this particular case, I had was able to experience what happens when a family is shattered because one of the members is deported. And that's something that most, you know, middle-class white families don't necessarily experience firsthand. We may have opinions about it or even sentiments about it, but then when you experience it firsthand, it becomes very, very personal. But the characters and the circumstance are all imagined. So Sweet is fictional. Bob Brown is fictional. Even the state legislator, who is the sponsor of the bill, is nothing, not even by gender, nothing like the actual state representative who did originally sponsor the real House Bill 1804. So I've created a fictional world and fictional characters, but the places are all real. So the little town of Cedar is very much modeled on the town where I am now, where my parents live, a little small town in the mountains of southeastern Oklahoma. The small town of Wilburton, which is in this same area, it's factual. When Sweet wants to go talk to her father and has to go stand outside the jail, outside the yard, to be able to talk to him because they don't allow visitors inside the jail, that's all fact. That's how they do it in Latimer County, Oklahoma. So there are many circumstances that are real, and yet there are characters who are fictional who are living out the consequences of real conditions.
Could you say a little bit about the impact on your family? Were there children involved in...
Yes, mm-hmm. yes. Yes, my and that is... The model in, you know, for the book is pretty close to that as well, which is that they did have a daughter. They do have a daughter who's much older than that now, but she was a preschooler when those things happened, and, you know, her father was there, and then he was not.
And how did that affect her?
She became very withdrawn. She was already a very quiet child. And at first she asked questions, and then she stopped asking questions, and then she stopped asking about her father.
Wow.
And then the struggle, the financial struggle that my niece went through, you know, you're a two-income family, and then suddenly you don't have that other income. And, you know, trying to navigate the labyrinthine regulations of immigration and all those things are really a challenge for the working poor.
One also experiences the sense of terror that people have, the terror of the hunted.
The terror of the hunted and the knowledge that my niece had that if she were, for instance, just stopped driving her husband to work, she would be arrested for a felony. Her daughter would be taken by, DHS, Department of Human Services. He would be deported. Now, this was before he actually was, that just living with your husband is a felony. And they're legally married, but... They were legally married, but it didn't make any difference in terms of the immigration laws. And that's something else that a lot of people don't understand, people who are not familiar with how complicated the immigration process is, especially for people from, you know, Central and South America. The rules are different for them. We don't have a sort of quota as we do for perhaps Eastern European countries. So when people talk about go back and get in line, What I learned, you know, through the experience of my niece is that they went through the entire process, and her husband had come here as a young boy. Well, we know how there's much talk about that these days relative to the Dream Act and so forth. He'd come here as a young, really as a youth, an early adolescent child, and had lived here in that time, and they married and had a child and went through all of the processes to get his immigration status legitimized. And the only thing that they had left to do was that he would have to go back to Mexico and apply to come legally. And they were told that it would be at least 10 years.
Rilla Askew. Go to writersvoice.net to hear my entire interview with her about her novel, Kind of Kin. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. Our webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.